Well, the wiggling continues. Second, the first column, now I'm on 324. And it really does continue. So the basic ideas will still characterize this discussion. Let me just look out for maybe important one-liners. He refers, just for the sake of mentioning it, in the third line, first column, 324, back to the bit where the snake wound around him and Salome could see. So we're back dealing with that issue. And he still feels crucified. And I think he's trying to get out of the crucifixion. Now, one thing I'm curious if anyone remembers, I couldn't find this. I don't remember it, but maybe somebody else remembers it, or maybe he's alluding to something we haven't heard yet. I've forgotten the dream where I saw my body lying on sharp needles and a bronze wheel rolling over my breast, crushing it. Does anyone remember having
that? That's in one of the images. A mandala type image where there were like four or more kind of sections.
Well, I'll find it if it's in the picture then. And was there a text to the picture describing the dream, or I just didn't remember it? Oh, okay. You see we're first column, 324?
Yeah.
Okay. Where it says 183, 184?
Here it is,
127. Oh, yeah.
Image 127.
That's right.
Okay, thanks, Carl. See what 183, 184? Just go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines. Where is it? Now I can.
I would go on without lament is the beginning of that line.
Yes, I would go on without lament. See what that is saying? Since I had not forgotten the dream where I saw my body lying on sharp needles and a bronze wheel rolling over my breast, crushing it. The meaning is not too hard to figure out. He's being crushed by this experience. I just didn't remember that image, but thanks, Carl. More dialogue. I don't want to accept you. I want you to accept me, etc., etc. And that's pretty much what that column does. Again, more wriggling. I lack the strength to hoist another fate onto my shoulders. I have enough to carry.
Where are you?
184, 185. Go up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 lines.
I lack the strength.
Yeah. This is all just, I'm just giving us examples of the struggle he's having, I think, to accept the Salome / Tony Wolf experience. And I think he really starts just bullshitting. Salome says, second column, are you sending me away? Why do you have the guts to say yes? No, he says, oh, I'm not sending you away. You must not be far from me, but give to me out of your fullness, not of your longing, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you can't talk to anybody like that. Nobody's full. Totally.
Even if it is, the fullness, the longing would be in the fullness.
Yeah, well, even better.
Well, this is his projection onto her.
Right.
What do you like her to be?
What he wants her to be.
In his imagination.
Yeah. But the bottom line is, which he will get to, I'm not trying to diminish him, is, you know, I like you, I'm stuck with you.
And Tony Wolfe was far from an empty bowl of yearning.
Yeah.
I mean, really, without her, he would not have made it.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So that continues on that column, pretty much. I mean, you can look at the sentences, but they go on and on, pretty much the same thing. Elijah says, you know, I wish you would accept my daughter, and so on. And it reaches the climax of absurdity in point two at the bottom of that page. Just listen to this. When everything was completed in me, I unexpectedly returned to the mysteries, to that first night of the otherworldly powers of the spirit and desire, just as I achieved pleasure in myself and power over myself. Well, we know that's nonsense. Salome had lost pleasure in herself, but learned to love for the other for God's sake. And Elijah had lost blah, blah, blah. And it goes on over to the end of the first paragraph on 325. Now it starts getting real. I hear Salome still crying. Wham! The emotion cuts through all of that rigmarole. What does she want? That's real. Or what do I still want? That's real. It is a damnable payment you have given to me, a payment that one cannot touch without sacrifice. That is real. One that requires even greater sacrifice once one has touched it. That is real.
So is reality objective, then? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the emotional demands of his development require a certain truthfulness from him.
The truth is an agent of some change. So if truth is evolving, how can you be objective?
Well, I'm not saying he's being objective.
Okay. That's what it sounds like.
Oh, but I am saying...
That's real.
Yeah.
That has the... Isn't the word real in the classical mind concrete?
This is an emotional reality.
Okay, all right, okay. It's not concrete.
Right, it is not concrete.
Okay, excuse me.
The serpent, now we're getting to some important discussions. Do you mean to live without sacrifice? Life must cost you something, doesn't it? I believe, already paid. I have rejected Salome. Is that not sacrifice enough? Too little for you. As has been said, you are allowed to make demands of yourself. He's now trying to get out of it again. Isn't it enough? I forced my feeling into the background. No, it's not enough. You're not forcing your feeling into the background at all. Rather, it suits you much better not to agonize further over Salome. Now we're hitting what is genuine emotional truth. And that continues down to, I am pulled upward. So that's why I don't feel bad having critiqued him, because he comes around. And I think once he hears Salome crying, that really is an answer to killing the Kabiri. Because with Salome, the Kabiri will never be far away.
I don't know what that word means.
Oh, they're the dwarves. Kabiris is the, there were two types of dwarves in Greek times. One were dactyls, and the other were Kabiri, and they're pretty much the same. They lived on different islands. I kind of forget who lived where, but the Kabiri, as dwarves, would symbolize creativity, because they were always the creative creators. Now, I am being pulled upward. See where I am? Go down.
That's the serpent is being pulled upward, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
So by accepting Salome, the serpent is being pulled upward. So that I understand that to mean if he accepts his mental, spiritual, creative, emotional, sexual relationship with Tony Wolf, that allows the meaning of his instinctual life to begin to surface. And the meaning of that was the creation of Jungian psychology. I think we touched on this before, but might be worth going back to it again. Then, I think this is so very important here. Then the serpent turned into a small white bird, which soared into the clouds, where she disappeared. My gaze followed her for a long time. So that the instinctuality turns in to the spirit. And by spirit I mean here the faculty by which he would create his psychology.
So remember earlier the serpent said that he gives him payment in images.
Yeah, right.
And does he have to become the bird before that is a possible?
I think
for him to receive the images.
Becoming the bird is instinct turning into image.
Okay.
That is the crucial dynamic throughout this whole book as I read it. How do you start with instinct and get image? Because the traditional religious view is you start with image. And what he's coming up with is no, you start with instinct and you get the image. How do you get the image? By living through the instinct. And if you're lucky, you might be able to get the image out of the instinct through imagination, but then you're very lucky. Most of the time, a creative person has to go through it instinctually. Now, as I say, I think we did this earlier. But I'd like to read you the dream, which repeats this image. This is from Memories, page 171. I'll read it, and then maybe it'll sound familiar, and then we'll talk about it. Then around Christmas of 1912, so right before all this stuff happened. No.
We're in 14, though.
Yeah, but we started October 1912, right?
13.
We started October 19. I think you're right, Carl. So this dream would have preceded this whole stuff. But I think it's part of the whole nexus. I had a dream. In the dream, I found myself in a magnificent Italian loggia with pillars, a marble floor, and a marble balustrade. I was sitting on a gold Renaissance chair. In front of me was a table of rare beauty. It was made of green stone like emerald. There I sat, looking out into the distance. For where I was sitting was set high up on the tower of the castle. My children were sitting at the table too. Suddenly a white bird descended, a small seagull or dove. Gracefully it came to rest on the table, and I signed to the children to be still so that they would not frighten away the pretty white bird. Immediately, the dove was transformed into a little girl about 8 years of age with golden blonde hair. She ran off with the children and played with them among the colonnades of the castle. I remained lost in thought, musing about what I had just experienced. The little girl returned and tenderly placed her arms around my neck. Then she suddenly vanished. The dove was back and spoke slowly in a human voice. Only in the first hours of the night can I transform myself into a human being, while the male dove is busy with the 12 dead. Then she flew off into the blue air, and I awoke. Same dove, I think. And you get this this shuttling back and forth between the dove and human life. Now, I don't know where I read this, but I am almost positive I'm not just fabricating this. It was out of this dream that Jung said, I have to take this relationship with Tony Wolf seriously. And I think his logic went somehow that the dove was what Tony Wolf was bringing to him. And the fact that his children were there meant to him, if he didn't take what Tony Wolf was bringing to him seriously, it would affect his children. So that this business of Salome and Tony Wolf, this would be another thing I would bring to say, I think that's what's going on. It's an inner anima and an outer anima at the same time, and the point of his going through it is to get the images then which became Jungian psychology.
Let me add a page again.
171 to 172. And of course that table that they're sitting around, this emerald table, remember the emerald table of Hermes?
Samargina.
Yeah, no, but that the Samargina is emerald table.
Emerald tablet, they call it.
But of whom? I think of Hermes, right?
Well, yeah, Hermes Trismegistus.
Yeah, Hermes Trismegistus. That was an Egyptian, not Egyptian, Hellenistic text.
I think so.
That the alchemist took as one of their founding texts. So you see, you get alchemy, you get the kids, you get the anima, all in the same dream. There's a lot more to it, but that's all I understand.
But it's so interesting that it was because of alchemy then that he and Tony, the actual outer woman, split.
Yeah. It's full of bitter ironies. So, but I think we're getting somewhere.
Doesn't have the H, right?
No,
H.
No H.
It's U.S.
It's just U.S.
I can Google it.
Yeah, okay. Do it.
We live in the E-H.
Google the pronunciation. I don't know if I can do that.
It's just. I think that's right.
All you have to do is put that word and pronunciation into the same Google box and it'll give you.
I think it's an I instead of U. But I'm not sure.
I think you're right.
Oh,
Francis
I am.
Francis Yates Giordano Bruno.
T-R-I-S-M-E-G-I-S-T-U-S.
Right,
T-R-I-S. It is T-U-S.
M-E-G-I-S-T-U-S.
It's T-U-S, I'm sorry.
Trismegistus.
Thrice Trismegistus. Great Hermes. Yes. That's what it means.
Trismegistus?
Yeah,
it's G-E-S-T-U-S.
T-R-I-S-M-E-G-I-S-T-U-S.
Yes, that's right.
Trismegistus. Well, see, you get try, that's three,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Majesty. I think maybe that's it. Maybe Majesty. Mm-hmm. Like Magister Budai. Yeah, everybody has it. I guess that. Thrice.
Great Hermes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't figure that out before. Yeah. Hermes Trismegistus.
I could swear that was an I in Yeats' book, but I'm not sure.
Well, there's probably different transliterations.
Yeah. It's just Greek. I think this would be Greek originally.
Yeah. All I did was look up the spelling.
Early alchemy started in Egypt. If you see embalming symbolism as the precursor of transforming substance into something eternal. And this guy, I guess, is a mythological figure who was thought to have, channeled or communicated a set of alchemical dictums which early alchemists took as their founding principles. You know that one you've heard, as above, so below? That's one of the tenets of this.
That's also the logos, right? Count Heraclitus, Diels Kron, B1 and B2.
Could be. I'm not that familiar with it. Interesting, I literally got in the mail 2 days ago Edinger's lecture on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll make you a copy if you want to listen to it. How do we get off on that?
Where are we talking about?
The emerald tablet. Yeah.
Mabel.
And the emerald tablet is the name of this text. The emerald tablet of Hermes Trismegistus. Probably at one time it was on an emerald tablet.
Engraved
on an emerald tablet, yeah. And it's from, I think, 300 AD or something like that. And it's a set of 10 or 12 or 15 precepts. But it is the foundation, it is that text that I think any alchemist would recognize as a foundation of their understanding. And so it's a clear reference to alchemy, is the bottom line here.
I think Yeats writes that somebody, and I can't remember his name, like Carterbon or somebody like that, had studied this and studied the history of all this and said that it couldn't have happened before 1600. That's why I remember Francis Yates' books, Giordano Bruno.
This text couldn't have happened.
Couldn't have happened. It had to be written later. If I'm remembering right. The guy who wrote was Carterbon, something like that. I think he was an Italian.
I don't know. I can't imagine that's correct because so many early ones would have referred to this.
I'll check it out and leave a message for you. Yeah. I'll make sure I got it right.
Any case, whatever it is, it's a reference to alchemy.
I love, though, that you refer to the Egyptians as the early alchemists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they tried to turn a corpse into a non-decaying body. And then that was extrapolated eventually into the alchemical mindset of making a piece of material sacred or
making the moral immortal.
Yeah, making the immortal, making the mortal immortal. Yeah.
So Jung had this dream long before he really delved into alchemy in any depth. But was he familiar with some alchemical?
That's a good question, Carl. I don't think. So any more than as a medical doctor, they would have probably studied the history of medicine. I don't think it was on his horizon. What was on his horizon were the Gnostics.
It says here that, of course, this is just, you know, the first thing on the internet, that he's a combination of Hermes, the Greek Hermes, and the Egyptian god Isis.
Right.
P-H-O-T.
Yeah. It's a Hellenistic phenomenon. So Greek and Egyptian coming together. Mm-hmm. And I think they say from Alexandria, from Hellenistic Alexandria.
Is have you touched on Hegel's?
I've read her stuff, yeah.
Do you have an opinion?
It's pretty solid, okay. I think, as far as scholarship goes.
First, Satan seems to agree with Jesus saying, now Jesus not as Christ, Jesus as the Jew. If it seems to equate with what he said to Peter, when he called Peter Satan. Remember, Jesus asked Peter, who do you think I am? He said, Lord, you are the Christ. This is in the New Testament, okay? Matthew, Mark, and John, I think. Three occurs in those three times places. And Jesus says, get away from me, Satan. So, for me, that's the validation of Christianity.
I see.
In my opinion, that's there it is right there for everybody to read. Get away from me, Satan. And the word Satan, according to Hegel in her book on Satan, is dialectic, is error. It's, Pirsig called it a genetic defect in human reason. Robert M. Pirsig in examining the art of motorcycle maintenance and life. So these things all come together and agree in the young, which is what I've been finding out. This stuff, it just lines up, it registers really well. Maybe I'm putting something into it.
No,
I think you're on target.
So, that's the bird.
Well,
now,
who are the 12 dead?
I think that's the ancestors.
It isn't the disciples.
Well, they would be some of the ancestors. But I don't think it's, you know, I don't remember exactly everything he said about it. And I don't know how strictly he would have interpreted that. I would imagine that the 12 dead could include the disciples, but not be limited to. But it's this whole idea of his that he felt he had to go back to previous eras of history and look at points of view that were once held to be true, which science has disproved, and return to them to see how they contain a truth that we need if understood on a different level. And that's the collective unconscious. So you could say it's the foundation of the collective unconscious.
And that corresponds to, is that right?
Yeah, that, roughly speaking.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a little bit broader than that, but that's a good starting point. Then he gets a crown. I think that might be the most important image in the book, as I thought about it. Let me talk about the crown a little bit.
Where are we again?
We are at, 189/draft.
Mm-hmm.
And now already lies in my hand a golden, well, let's go back a step. So we got the bird. So go to the bird above that 189. Mm-hmm. do you hear me? I'm far off now. Heaven is so far away. Hell is much nearer the earth. I found something for you, a discarded crown. It lay on a street in the immeasurable space of heaven, a golden crown. And now it already lies in my hand, a golden royal crown, with lettering and size within. What does it say? Love never ends. A gift from heaven, but what does it mean? Well, what is interesting here, we have in Jungian literature a lot of work on crowned figures. But as far as I know, only one on crown. I thought we'd look at that. And that's in Mysterium. I shudder from opening Mysterium from time to time. So I went to the Mysterium Lectures, which is a lot more accessible. And this is on page 27, 28, and 29. In in that part of Mysterium, Jung is interpreting an alchemical recipe called Austenes caught in Hymarmony. Should I put that up?
Austenes caught in Hymarmony. Hymarmony is the compulsion of the star.
And Austenes is the name of the guy. And the idea is he starts out feeling a victim, if we put it in modern language, to his astrological chart. That's Hymarmony. You know, if your Venus is in a certain place, you're going to have this and this. And that's great if it's a positive constellation, and if it's a negative effect, then it's not so great. And in in the text, he starts out, Austenes says in the text, I am caught between these influences of the planets. That's how the text starts. And then he says a bunch of other stuff. And he then goes on a journey through different colored lands. Finally, he gets to the good serpent. And he is freed from being caught in Hymarmony. And when he is freed, he is crowned. That's how the crown comes in here. And so Jung mentions this as his interpretation endpoint. We'll go back and look at this text a little bit more. The crown signifies the kingly totality. It stands for unity and is not subject to Hymarmony. So what has happened, he's caught in these influences. And the way Jung interprets going through these different colored locations is he's getting to know all the different parts of himself, all the different emotionally toned colored parts of himself. And when he faces all of himself completely, then he gets in touch with the healing aspect of the psyche, and he's freed from those influences that have been manipulating him like a marionette. So the crown symbolizes freedom attained through facing one's totality. As far as I know, it's the only place where Jung just talks about the crown as a crown. So what the crown represents is the freedom that comes through self-knowledge. And it encompasses and represents, as a mandala, the fact that we've been through it all. And by facing what we need to face, we are freed from destructive choices. I mean, I'm making it very simple. But so you see, that's what he's given now. He tried to get rid of Salome. But now the crown suggests he's going to go through Salome and Tony to get to his place of freedom. So it's an extremely important image. And again, I think, to go back with the question I raised at the very beginning, to do that, he's never going to be able to kill his creativity. And interestingly, he did continue. Now I'm going back to where we started today. He continued developing his psychology till the very end. He brought in synchronicity at the end. He redefined his concept of the archetype at the end. He started discussing the questions of the archetype's relationship to psyche and matter, so that he didn't kill his creativity. And I think what we've seen just in these pages today is his wrestling with himself to go through what it took to continue remaining creative his whole life. And he does get somewhere. And that crown is an indication he has really gotten somewhere. Which you wouldn't know if you don't do a little, you know, comparative research into the crown.
Was this section of the Mysterium some kind of imaginative experience that he's talking about, or is he talking about a mythical
event? That text that he's interpreting is actually an alchemical recipe.
Oh, that's right.
And then he's interpreting that alchemical recipe psychologically and seeing how, if you look at it as a metaphor, what the alchemist thought was you had to put that prima materia through all these different states. Through a red state, through a black state, through a yellow state, through whatever else. And he's just interpreting that metaphorically. That we have to go through all our different colors, you might say, and face our shadow, our anima, or, you know, to get free from influences that control us. And the crown represents that we've gotten to know all ourselves, and by doing so, we have achieved a wholeness that frees us from being manipulated by influence. So that crown is the end of the story.
Hess implied that we were all schizophrenic because of all those cells.
Who did?
Hess in Steppenwolf.
Well,
that's a great read, by the way.
You know, Hess saw Jung.
Is Saul Jung?
He saw Jung as a patient.
Oh, he saw Jung, okay.
And it didn't work.
Didn't work?
No.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I have to find that.
Yeah, it's in a book, Miguel Serrano, S-E-R-R-A-N-O. It's called Hesse and Jung, A Record of Two Friendships. Now, I liked Hesse very much. I'm not knocking him. But I don't think he ever got past his complexes. He stayed stuck in all the colors, Hesse did. That's why Magister Luthi commits suicide at the end of his last book.
Yeah, that was killing the hero for me.
Oh.
That's how I saw that. But, you know, there were two before that, Truru and Josephus. Is that right?
I don't remember. It's been years since I got into this.
So he had to go through the Truru adventure, and then he had to go through the Josephus adventure, and then... his killing of his hero ending his own life so that he could do the next iteration.
Well, that's a nice way to look at it. Yeah.
That's a great book.
Mm-hmm.
Incredible. 46 Nobel Prize in Literature, 1946.
Did it?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Glass Bead Game, I think, is the other name of it.
Magister Luthi, Glass Bead Game.
Yeah, seems like you're ready to say so.
I'm just kind of trying to put something together in my head. Mm-hmm. Could we say before the crown, the reason he might have wanted to kill the Kabiri is because he was tormented by this influx of creativity, mm-hmm. and he had really no way of dealing with it, mm-hmm. just as maybe this influx of eroticism mm-hmm. was very difficult.
But I think they're the exact same thing.
That once the crown comes, then that can flow through him in a much more creative way, allowing it to have a life that will serve a purpose.
I certainly feel that.
Okay.
But the price is, I got to deal with it.
Right.
And that's what he's coming to grips with. What I'm going to have to deal with, I'm going to have to give up my academic career, I have to give up my friends, I'm going to have to deal with a tense situation in my marriage, but I'm going to do it.
So could you say that that part where he wanted to kill a kambiri might be the equivalent of the Garden of Gethsemane, the point before Jesus was crucified?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a different crucifixion, because when you're inundated with all of that,
yeah,
you're stuck kind of on the cross.
Yeah.
But the crucifixion to the self is a totally different thing.
That's a very important point, I think. See, sacrifice, you would think, oh, give her up. Sacrifice is going to the experience. And sacrifice your persona, your well-being, your good sleep. You're going to lose social status. You're going to lose your position at the university. That's the sacrifice. So it's almost like just the flip side. That's why I get nervous on this word sacrifice, because it usually means give up your instincts. And here the sacrifice is pay the price for living your instincts. how far did we get? Let's say we got to the end of the crown. 325.
Well, we can talk about Salome and Jung's conversation on the crown much. Happening just at the end of the page.
Yeah, well, yeah, we'll pick up with that. Yeah, we'll pick up with that. So we'll say we got as far as 189 slash draft. And I don't know how the rest of this will go, but I'd read the 226, so why don't you read... I don't know whether we'll be able to go fast or not. Some of this, you know, it's just repeat. I don't think we need to look at everything again. So 1, 2, 3. Why don't you read over to 329? Gosh, we're almost finished.
Well, 330 is just...
Why don't you finish the freaking Liber Secundus? We have the scrutinies ahead. I assume you want to keep going. I don't know what the scrutinies are like. As I tell you, I'm a couple pages ahead of you. We have actually done something.
Yeah. So much. A lot of good stuff
to do. I thought so too. I mean, you can feel it. Will be interesting. I got to talk to a musician who knows symphonies. I don't know. Do you know symphonies? Probably
yeah,
that's not your genre. I always feel like we've been listening to a symphony, and you know it reached a point where you think, oh yes, and then it went to another movement, and then another movement, oh yes, and then it went to another movement, and now we've really had a finale in these last pages today, where that the musical pieces themes are being resolved, but not yet, not completely. There'll be another unresolved. I don't know if there's a symphony where you could identify that or not, but it would be a nice context.
Monty Mahler Resurrection Symphony number 2.
Is that the way it is, that it reaches a climax, but then not quite, and then starts again?
I haven't listened to it in a long time, but it's pretty powerful.
Well, if you hear of one, let me know.
Okay.
It'd be nice. I really feel it's like a symphony. And today was really a wonderful finale, where you could see the wrestle, and then accepting, and then... an enormous amount of it has been accomplished.
The crown is a symbol of what's possible, gives him some hope.
Yeah.
All of this. Obviously, he's got a whole life ahead of him to
earn that crown.
Yeah, exactly. But he now knows, you know, this difference between depression and despair. With depression, you know what you want to do, but you can't do it. With despair, you don't know what you can do, but you know you can do it. And he's resolved his despair. He's realizing now what he can do, what the work is to do.
Yeah, I mean, as an image, I see that crown and all the kabiri filtering through that,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a way to make it manageable, that influx of creative ideas. Because if you think about the breadth of his work, if that were all coming at you at one time, it could drive you over the edge.
Yes.
So if he has a means of funneling that through the crown, then it's manageable.
That's another nice way to put it, yeah. Okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks.